I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the accused perpetrator of this weekend's shooting in Buffalo, New York, referenced a racist idea known as the Great Replacement Theory in his alleged online writings. An expert on extremism joins the show to talk about the conspiracy theory's origins and why versions of it have become increasingly mainstream.
First, Wisconsin's Bipartisan Elections Commission has been the target of Republican criticism since the 2020 election.
The four GOP candidates running for governor against Tony Evers have all called for either overhauling or eliminating the commission altogether.
Here's how former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish made her case in an interview earlier this year with WTAQ in Green Bay.
I think they have turned our elections into a circus. And so I think whether we choose to put it under the legislature or the Secretary of State's office, elections in Wisconsin must have more authority for the voters so that they have essentially one throat to choke. They need to be able to bounce someone from office, whether it's the Secretary of State or their legislator, if elections go wrong.
Democrats, including Governor Evers, have rejected calls by Republicans to disband the commission. Some Republican legislative leaders, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, have also rejected the idea.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how elections are run in Wisconsin? Do you support the Wisconsin Elections Commission? Do you think it should be overhauled or abolished altogether? Are there ways you think it could be improved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org.
Philip Chen is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Beloit College. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always happy to be here.
Let's start with the creation of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. First of all, Phil, can you tell us a little bit of the history going back to 2015 of the creation of this state elections agency?
Sure. It was established in 2015 basically to replace the Government Accountability Board, which was actually established in the early 2000s as a response to what was a legislative scandal where a number of state employees on both Democrats and Republicans were found to be campaigning with a campaigning for either their selves or their bosses. To the tune of like almost $4 million in state taxpayer money. So the Government Accountability Board was established in order to provide some oversight of campaigns and the way that elections are run. And then in 2015, after years of especially Republican objections to the Government Accountability Board, which was nonpartisan, so it always had nonpartisan former judges. It was replaced in 2015 with the Wisconsin Elections Commission as well as the State Ethics Board. So it was split into two different bodies. And the Wisconsin Elections Commission now is a bipartisan election commission. So the commissioners are associated with one party or the other, but there's always an even 3-3 split.
Why has there been a strong push now from Republicans to overhaul or remove this elections commission?
Well, again, I think part of the reason is that, I mean, I think a large part of the reason is that the Wisconsin Elections Commission made a certain number of determinations in the last few elections regarding things like ballot drop boxes, voting in nursing homes and things like that, that after the election, Republicans sort of targeted as things that they did not like and did not want to see repeated in future elections. And so there's no way for Republicans in the state legislature to sort of exert power over the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission. And so it's become a target. The commission has become a target because Republicans who might want to eliminate some of these or change the decisions that are made simply don't have that power with a bipartisan commission.
Talking to Phil Chen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Beloit College, looking at the Wisconsin Election Commission calls by the Republican candidates for governor to change it a lot or get rid of it and replace it with another system. You can join in with your thoughts on that idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phil, one idea that's been floated by some of the candidates is get rid of the commission, replace it with the Secretary of State, a partisan elected position in Wisconsin that currently doesn't really do much of anything. A lot of states, almost half of states, I believe, have some version of this where the Secretary of State runs things. Can you talk about that idea?
Yeah, I actually think last I checked, I think it's around 32 states. So about 60% of states, I think, vest their election administration in the Secretary of State's office. So, you know, I mean, it's neither model is unusual. I mean, what was unusual was the Government Accountability Board. A nonpartisan board was kind of an anomaly, but was actually widely praised by people who study these kinds of boards as a nice model. The bipartisan model, not that rare. So, you know, I mean, the difference, of course, is that the Secretary of State is an elected position and thus is, you know, if not accountable for their decisions, at least voters have the ability to vote that person in or out of office if they disagree with the things that they have done.
Do people see cons to that idea in states where this exists, where the Secretary of State runs an election?
You know, it's again, I think that one of the biggest sort of advantages of these boards is that they are not as subject to the whims of the voters, right? That you know, this idea that you want it's a matter of where you sort of place your priority. Do you want the decisions being made to be accountable to the voters, or do you want them being made you know, based on interpretations of existing law? And so I would say that the critiques are similar to the critiques we see as to, you know, in state Supreme Courts where you have elected versus appointed state Supreme Court justices. Do you want your members of the court to be directly accountable to voters, or would you rather have them sort of divorced from that electoral accountability? So again, the pros and cons are kind of similar to the ones we see in the court system in thinking about whether you would like to see your elections administered with the voters having some kind of say in that process.
As we heard in that clip from former Lieutenant Governor Clayfish, now running for governor, she's also said, or the legislature running elections. I was looking at the list. I don't know that any state allows the legislative body to do that. It would be a little different than usual because that would be taking an executive function, how things work, and putting it in the hands of the legislature. Do you have thoughts on that idea, Phil?
You know, I don't know what that would look like because, as you said, it simply is not an idea that is widely used. If I can't think of anywhere where the legislature is specifically in charge of running the elections. You're right. It's an executive position that where the decisions are often made by the Secretary of State or by the commission. So passing that to the legislators seems like an odd idea, an idea that is not widely used in American politics, and would seem to lend itself really, really, really problematically to the issues that were occurring in the early 2000s, late 1990s, that originally drove the state to adopt these kinds of boards.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the big issue that we have is most of the staffers or all the staffers are from Madison. So they're in the Madison bubble. And so all the information they provide up to the decision makers are all from a liberal, left-wing, progressive lens. And the best thing that we can do is move the board, whatever the board is, out of Madison to make sure there's more diversity of thought within the ranks of the people that are making the recommendations.
Steve, thanks for the call. What do you think of that idea, Phil? The agency works in Madison. I don't know where the people live. The actual commissioners half Republican appointees, half Democratic appointees. But Steve worried about the staff in a liberal bubble, he says.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not all that convinced that moving it to a different place in the state would make a difference. But I don't think if that's the solution that the legislature or the governor comes up with, I don't think there's any particular harm in that. I think that my guess is that the staff actually have less of a influence over the commissioners than Steve might expect. I really do think that the commissioners, because they're appointed from multiple areas of the state and from both political parties, really do bring their own knowledge and expertise to the job. But if that's the decision is to move it to another part of the state, I don't think there's any particular harm in that.
Steve, thanks for that call. We're talking about the future of Wisconsin's elections and who's in charge of them. Phil Chen is with us, political science professor at Beloit College. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Wisconsin Elections Commission? Do you want to see it continue operating the way it has been? Do you think it's working well? Are there decisions it made that you agreed with or didn't agree with in that pandemic year election of 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Dean Knetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with political science professor Phil Chen from Beloit College. He's with us today looking at how Wisconsin elections are run and what could happen if the State Elections Commission is abolished, as some Republican candidates for governor have proposed.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Let it ride as it is? Or if the Elections Commission went away, who would you want running our elections in the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Linda is with us in Eau Claire. Linda, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I think the election commission is fine just the way it is. This state is so gerrymandered. There's no way in heck that it should be given to a legislature to make decisions on it. It's just fine. And anybody who thinks it should be changed, I think it's for political reasons. It's just fine the way it is. People have input into it. Vote. That's our input. Input into it. Thank you.
Linda, thanks for the call. Phil, what do you think of what Linda had to say?
I mean, I think she's absolutely right that moving election administration to the state legislature is dangerous, given the level of documentable empirical gerrymandering that has occurred in the state legislature. But again, I don't, I'm not even sure that's a viable possibility given the sort of anomalous status of something like that would be. But even moving it to the Secretary of State's office does raise real concerns about the sort of politicized nature. As Linda said, people do have say in who gets appointed to the Elections Commission because they're appointed by elected officials. And so the danger of moving it to the Secretary of State's office is that we are seeing, historically, these have been sort of the campaigns for secretaries of state have been focused on sort of electoral experience. What, have you served on maybe the elections committee in the state legislature or something like that? Now we're starting to see that even those positions are becoming very, very polarized and politicized. We see this in Georgia with primary challenges to the sitting Republican Secretary of State. And so to the extent the Secretary of State races become more like partisan races, it raises some real concerns about whether the decisions that were made by that office would be either political in nature or truly about sort of correct interpretations of the law.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Phil, before we go back to our callers, another candidate, Republican Tim Michaels, running for office, has floated the idea of keeping this elections commission, but dismissing the entire board, firing all the top-level employees, cancel existing guidance to local clerks, and then start over with a new board. So sweep the board clean and sort of rebuild it from the ground up. What do you see the potential impact of that being?
You know, again, I think it's it might make a difference, but you're still drawing, you're going to be drawing people who are appointed because of some kind of desire from the individuals appointing them. So, yeah, maybe you would, given that it would be appointed by, you know, the governor and the minority leader or majority leader in the state legislative bodies. Yeah, you might, you know, you what you might end up with is a more partisan but a still divided board because of the sort of the context of when they're being appointed. Some of the other things proposed are actually sort of odd. You know, the proposal to sort of twice yearly purge voters, that's actually less frequent than the board currently does that. So there are some things that suggest that that may not be the most the reform may not be totally in line with what is even happening at the Wisconsin Elections Commission. But again, you're still drawing people, and as far as those who have the expertise to apply for those jobs, there's still only a limited number of people who have that expertise. And so it might not hurt, but it might not help the sort of the end goal that that they're hoping to get out of this.
Talking to Phil Chen from Beloit College about Wisconsin's election commission, calls from Republican candidates for governor in particular to abolish or change it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I've been reading a lot about, we have 19 GOP-run states right now that have installed either partisan boards or work to put, as your guest was alluding to, the power to determine elections into the Secretary of State's hands. And that gives them the ability to overturn elections that they deem fraudulent, which means if we were back in 2020, many of these boards would have deemed the 2020 election fraudulent, likely, and overturned that election. And so going forward, we're creating a scenario where what was attempted to be done in 2020 through illegal means is now going to be done through, you know, quote unquote, legal means. And it's essentially taking the power out of the citizens' hands and handing it over to partisan officials who are going to decide who won an election.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Phil, do you share that concern that some changes might make it possible to, in effect, overturn the popular vote, overturn the will of the voters?
I mean, I do share that concern because of the narrative and the language that has been used by a number of Republican election officials in the wake of the 2020 election. You know, I think that, and more importantly, the way that that though that narrative conflicts with the documentable, verifiable, empirical evidence of the sheer lack of fraud. And so I really do worry that even if they are, this is the goal and it is ultimately unsuccessful, it deeply undermines the public's trust in elections. And so I think that my concern is not just with whether this is actually the goal, it may be, it may not, but my concern is that it's deeply harmful to the trust that people place in the elections and the fairness of the elections.
Thanks for that call. One of the candidates we haven't mentioned yet, Timothy Ramthan, is a state lawmaker who's tried to introduce legislation to overturn, to withdraw, in effect, Wisconsin's electors from 2020, and is still campaigning to do that. If that is the motivation here, do you worry that these changes, in particular in Wisconsin, might make it easier to do that, even if 2020 is a done deal?
You know, it's difficult to say, right? Because a lot of it will depend on how the legislation is written, how the power is vested. But if you have a candidate for governor who has an expressed desire to overturn the the outcome of an election and replace presidential electors with a different slate, it raises real concerns. It's hard to know what would actually happen in that scenario. I don't want to speculate, but I would say it raises concerns that is a serious possibility. If a governor were in place who wanted to do this and had a friendly secretary of state, this is why these nonpartisan or bipartisan boards are often drawn up the way they are, is to protect against, a single individual's sort of using their power in such a way.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Yes. I firmly believe when it was the Government Accountability Board was probably the best we saw for a nonpartisan way to look at it. Under the Walker regime, it became the Elections Commission. And now if we're going to turn it over or think about turning it over to the Wisconsin State Legislature, when you live in a state that is as highly gerrymandered as Wisconsin is, we have a Republican legislature. How are you going to keep this nonpartisan?
Nancy, thanks for the call. Phil?
I mean, I think the short answer is there's no intention to keep the election administration nonpartisan. And in many states, secretaries of state are elected as partisan individuals. In fact, most states, that's the case. And so this is where that conflict comes in. I think a lot of people seem to like the Government Accountability Board because it was explicitly nonpartisan. And the Wisconsin Election Commission was kind of this middle ground of saying, okay, well, we'll make it bipartisan, but it'll still be a commission. And to the extent that people want their elections administered in a nonpartisan or a bipartisan manner, moving to a Secretary of State, especially a partisan Secretary of State election like we have in Wisconsin, really removes any of that pretense of impartiality.
Thanks for that call. And Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That's Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Bloyd College, with us today looking at the role of the Wisconsin Elections Commission and possible alternatives proposed by Republican candidates for governor.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the threat posed by domestic extremism as a shooting in Buffalo, New York is being investigated as a racially motivated hate crime. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up, libraries around the state are using federal relief funds to expand the services they offer. We'll find out what they're doing, and we'll invite you to call in about your local library.
Now, an armed assailant shot 13 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York over the weekend, leaving 10 people dead.
Most of the victims of the shooting were Black, and authorities are investigating the attack as a racially motivated hate crime.
In online posts attributed to him, the accused perpetrator expressed white supremacist and anti-Black ideas, including a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement. Our next guest says that idea was for a while on the fringes, but has become increasingly mainstream.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about domestic extremism in the U.S.? Do you have questions about extremist ideas and how they spread? Have you heard a version of this Great Replacement theory online or on TV? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Cynthia Miller Idris is the director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. It's also called PERIL for short. She's the author of two books on extremism. Her most recent is Hate in the Homeland, the New Global Far Right. Cynthia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about this Great Replacement conspiracy theory and where it came from?
Yes. Well, the theory itself, the conspiracy, has roots, obviously, that have been around a long time. So in the U.S. for decades, there's been a conspiracy theory called white genocide, which says that there's an orchestrated plot to eradicate white civilizations. And in Europe, there's been a conspiracy theory called Eurabia, which says that Muslim elites are trying to expand the caliphate through demographic change and immigration. And so these roots have been there for a really long time. But about a decade ago, this conspiracy called the Great Replacement kind of became an umbrella concept on dark spaces online that that united sort of white supremacists across the world. And we saw terrorist attacks in Oslo and in Christchurch, New Zealand, and then El Paso, Pittsburgh here, and now in Buffalo, that have all been really mobilized by those same ideas, that it's an orchestrated plot, that it is to gain power, and that there is an existential threat to white people. So it really is circulates in dark spaces online and mobilizes terrorist actors. But over the past couple of years, we've seen it much more frequently show up in mainstream political discourse and on cable news networks as well.
Before we turn to that mainstreaming, can you talk about, I guess, what is it, an informal online network that really promotes and harbors these ideas now online?
Yeah, this is a great question, because it's really hard to explain how networked online extremism works. It is, I think it's exactly the way to describe it, is that it is like a network. These are not lone wolves or lone actors in the sense of completely isolated people out in a cabin somewhere. They are very socially engaged online, but they're not members typically of groups the way that 20 or 30 years ago we would see. And even today, there are extremist groups where people have, you know, initiation rites and membership lists, and you sign up and you're a card-carrying member of an extremist group. That does still exist, but the vast majority of what's happening today is young people, especially spending time, teenagers and young adults, in on meme sharing sites, watching videos in online gaming chat rooms, sharing texts with their friends that have memes or video snippets or jokes that have really racist and misogynist and disgusting kind of content in them, that also that in some of these cases explain that there's a conspiracy or refer to a conspiracy called the Great Replacement. So the terrorist shooter in Christchurch, his manifesto was called the Great Replacement. I mean, this became a kind of unifying, and he live streamed his attack as well, just like the Buffalo shooter did. And so there was a lot of imitation here. Even the Buffalo shooter really plagiarized most of the so-called manifesto. Those 180 pages was plagiarized, the content from the Christchurch manifesto.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at a conspiracy theory, the replacement, great replacement theory, cited by the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator of the Buffalo shooting. She says it's getting more mainstream, though. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. You could tell us if you've encountered this. Now, you mentioned, Cynthia, you're seeing this more, a version of this more in American politics and media. I want to listen to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. He was talking here about immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border on Fox News last year.
This administration wants complete open borders, and you have to ask yourself why. Is it really they want to remake the demographics of America to ensure that they stay in power forever? Is that what's happening here? Because the human depredations that's being caused by their policies, they're just untold.
Senator Johnson made a similar statement last month in a radio interview. I think Republicans and some on the media, including Tucker Carlson, are saying, wait, we're saying something different than this replacement theory in its classic form. Their argument is Democrats want to allow immigrants in, give them amnesty and let them vote. Amnesty, of course, wouldn't let them vote. But that's the basic idea. How strong a connection do you see between those two versions?
I would say the mainstream version of it is a kind of, it's an echo of the darker terrorist version of it. And it shares features. So there's still a plot, there's still orchestration, there's some kind of conspiracy to do it. And it's positioning the change that's coming, a demographic change, as a terrible outcome. It's often using dehumanizing language against immigrants. referring to dirty or poor immigrants, for example, we hear that sometimes in the same context as we hear replacing. And it'll use language like traditional America is being replaced instead of talking about going straight to the issue of race. So there's a lot of euphemisms, it's softer, and they're not calling for violence. That's a really important distinction. But it creates a bridge, I think, is a way of thinking about it, or an echo. So when someone is encountering the dark version of this online, and then maybe their parents are listening to a cable, you know, listening to Fox News in the background, or they hear somebody at the dinner table mention the similar kinds of things, that's where the potential, I think, for reinforcement comes in.
Now, of course, the worst case is an attack like the one we saw in Buffalo this weekend. How do you see that happening? Someone going from being exposed to these ideas, then embracing them, and then acting on them in this horrific burst of violence?
Well, you know, there's very little research that tells us actually what makes one person who is radicalized become violent and take that leap to violence while another person does not. So, you know, that's really tricky. You can actually only look at it afterward. But there are some key elements that people share in common across violent actors. And one is that they often position themselves as being heroic. So what, you know, they believe they're saving somebody, their people, or that they are called upon to act as martyrs. And so at some point they've encountered bad content online, often shared from, you know, in a text chat with a group of friends from school or a meme, or they go to these, chan sites or in an online gaming chat where they're encountering these ideas. Somebody shares a hyperlink. I mean, this is the way that ecosystem works online, that takes them to another video. And then the algorithm recommends videos that other people have watched. And that can lead them darker and darker and sort of deeper into a rabbit hole of propaganda. And there's been pretty good coverage showing that that can happen pretty quickly. Even within the span of a few days, if you're in a binge watching period, you can encounter content that later gets banned, right? Because the content moderation is always slower and people do see stuff. So, but then once people believe this, they really deeply believe the conspiracy theory, what typically mobilizes them to action is some combination of wanting to be a part of something bigger and better than themselves. They think that they're acting to save their people, or they really want a sense of power and they want to be admired or imitated by others. And we really saw that very clearly here in this Buffalo case where he's trying to get others to follow him.
And you offer through your organization, PERL, the Polarization Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, advice for parents and others if they worry that a youth in their life, their own kid, may be going down this path. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time, some of those resources. What kind of off-roads are there?
It's a great question. And, you know, we created that Parents and Caregivers Guide at the start of the pandemic when we were watching so many millions of teens and kids go online all the time, and also knew that propaganda was circulating in higher amounts. So we were really concerned about parents and caregivers being kind of now the frontline adults who might be able to recognize warning signs. So the first thing we advise parents to do is try to react with curiosity. When you do hear warning signs, when we've had parents say that their kids have started expressing extreme misogyny during the pandemic, for example, or they hear their child say something that's Holocaust denial related, you know, or making a joke about something horrific. And often parents react with shame and they shame their child. Those aren't our values. And what are you doing? Or they punish them. And that can actually drive kids, especially further online, into spaces where they are then welcomed and celebrated. And people say your parents just are triggered snowflakes who can't take a joke. And things can get worse. So we try to urge parents, it's very hard, but to react with curiosity, to try to treat their kids as experts, ask them, where did you find that? Can you explain what a meme is? How does this space work where you spend a lot of time? And trying to draw them out and then start to disentangle what is underneath and behind it so that they can start to kind of understand.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller Idris, professor and director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. We're looking at extremist ideology and the potential link to violence.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think misinformation and disinformation play a big role in the spread of these extremist ideas? Do you worry about young people being radicalized online? Have you encountered this in your own life? Should there be more training for adults to spot the warning signs of radicalization? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Knetter. We're talking about extremism in the U.S. after a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York last week. Cynthia Miller Idris with American University stays with us.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your comments, maybe your own experiences. If you've encountered these ideas, maybe on social media or elsewhere, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Bernie is with us in Valders. Bernie, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that, you know, everything old is new again. Yes, we have the internet now, but just give you a brief background to my family. my father was a survivor of Neuen Gamma concentration camp. And he was actually captured by the Germans in Ukraine. He was born in Ukraine, which was then the Second Republic of Poland, sent to Neuen Gamma, which was a slave labor camp. And for a lot of the same reasons, you know, there was just an economic hatred between Ukrainians, Poles, Germans. Of course, we all know the story of the Nazis, but long story short, he came to the U.S., got to the U.S., and people who were brought here as immigrants, refugees after the war, were known as DPs, displaced persons. And, you know, growing up, I heard the term damn DP an awful lot, and I didn't really understand what it was then, but eventually my dad brought us here to Wisconsin because he didn't like what was happening to him. Every time he opened his mouth with his deep Eastern European accent, you know, in the early 60s, somebody accused him of being a communist. We came here, here into Wisconsin, and my dad bought a farm. He had saved up enough money to buy a farm near Mount Calvary. The local guy who wanted to buy the farm was angry with my dad for buying the farm, and in a conversation with him said the following. Our boys went over to Europe and fought and died for your people, and now you come here and you marry our women and take our land.
Bernie, thank you for sharing. Obviously, a still painful story. Cynthia, Bernie sees a long history of this suspicion of the immigrant.
There is a long history, and we're hearing, and I hear the pain in Bernie's story and the way that carried across generations. I mean, when we talk about intergenerational trauma, the kind of trauma that people carry on, when we hear and in hearing the pain in the communities, voices in Buffalo right now is so palpable too, and feeling that it's really important to not just pay attention here to the perpetrators of hate and harm and violence and terrorism, but also to how we direct resources to survivors and to victims and to communities who are the most harmed by those actions.
Bernie, thanks for sharing your family's story at 800-642-1234. Jackie joins us next in Illinois. Jackie, hello. Are you there, Jackie? Oh, we lost Jackie. Jackie had said they don't agree that Fox News necessarily spreads replacement theory. They view themselves as a Fox viewer, but not a supporter of the great replacement theory. And I think looking at Fox News in particular, Cynthia, there is a news division. There are reporters. It's not necessarily wall to wall on the network. People have focused attention on the highly rated Tucker Carlson show in particular.
No, that's right. And, you know, and I do think it's important to distinguish between the great replacement conspiracy theory that's mobilizing terrorist violence and the versions of it that we're hearing on Fox News and from mainstream politicians, but also to recognize the harm. I mean, it is being celebrated by white supremacists online that it's being mentioned on Fox News and by Tucker Carlson. So we're calling, using words like ally and saying, finally, you know, he's saying it. So it is seen as legitimizing within those spaces. And I think it's really important to understand that and to disavow it and to speak out against it. So I'm glad to hear, you know, hear him say that he is not a supporter of the Great Replacement. I think we should be hearing more people say that.
Even if the transmission of the Great Replacement theory doesn't lead to acts of violence, do you worry about it doing harm in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, it is, even if it's not violent, you know, we want a society. We are a country that has absorbed millions of immigrants, and that has, you know, that has been a place where people seek out opportunities, and we want that to be, you know, to continue to be the case. And so, even when it doesn't mobilize violence, it mobilizes, you know, it has discriminatory and racist and dehumanizing ideas attached to it that give people a sense of threat, that make them feel that they are, you know, in danger, or that there is potential harm coming to their family or their traditions or their lives. And so I think one of the questions we should be asking is, you know, why is it a threat? Why is demographic change being perceived as such a threat? Why, what does it take for everyone who lives in a country to feel at home in the place where they live?
Talking to Cynthia Miller Idris from the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at far-right conspiracy theories and extremism. Cynthia, I want to spend our last few minutes looking at solutions. You've called for what you call a public health approach to violent extremism. What would that look like?
Well, you know, most of our allies overseas treat domestic extremism as a societal problem, not just a security problem. We in this country have framed this problem around the Department of Homeland Security, which, you know, has done a lot with what they have to prevent things, but it makes it really more about, you know, screening and safety and sort of barricading the doors and training people to disarm in a crisis, right? And of course, you want some of that crisis training, and we have seen it be successful in places like the Colleyville hostage taking situation, where that rabbi was able to get away by using that training. But, you know, the way I often describe it is, I don't want to live in a world where barricading the doors is all that we can do, is that that's our measure of success. And I don't think anybody wants to live that way. So we want to prevent, a public health approach is saying, we treat this the same way that we've treated diabetes or cardiac disease, which is also educate communities about the attitudinal behavioral choices they can make that help them resist propaganda and understand what manipulative rhetoric looks like online, so they can make their own choices with all the freedoms of speech that we have to be safer in our own communities.
Now, we've seen things like the teaching of race in schools in the U.S. get really politicized. I'm sure you're aware of that. But if kids don't talk about this in schools, are they going to see it, learn about it on the streets, or I guess more notably on the internet?
Yeah, I think that's exactly a really important point, which is that, you know, that there is a lot of information online, especially in these dark spaces, that presents false information about racial differences, that uses genetic and eugenicist kind of ways of thinking that positions racial differences as biological and harmful. And if kids don't learn about racial inequality and the legacies of racial inequality and racism in this country from trusted adults and curriculum that we know about, they are going to go ask those questions and be given answers online. And those answers often are full of propaganda and disinformation in ways that create tremendous harm. So I think of it as inoculating, as protecting, as pre-bunking the disinformation and the harmful content, and safeguarding young people, especially as they spend time online, by equipping them with the skills to be resilient.
Briefly, as we wrap up, given that all these issues are politicized, do you see those things having a chance of happening in schools?
Unfortunately, I think that, you know, we see it takes the deaths of so many people, that a tragedy like this, to have more open conversations now than I feel like we were able to have a week ago about it, where people are starting to understand, I think, the consequences of not having conversations about race in schools. So I do think that we have a chance. I just hope that it doesn't take another tragedy to move the needle further.
Cynthia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, author of two books about extremism. She was with us today to talk about the Great Replacement Theory and how to counter domestic extremism after the shooting at a Buffalo, New York grocery store.
Coming up.
You can find resources, thanks Dean, for Peril on youth radicalization for parents, caregivers, educators, and more at WPR.org/Central Time.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, scientists have captured the first ever image of a massive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. A UW astronomer joins the show for a look at the discovery and what black holes do. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Are you good at Wheel of Fortune? Here's an opportunity for you, a live touring version of the TV show, not for broadcast, not with Pat and Vanna. It's coming to Wisconsin in December, according to a new announcement, with stops in Madison and Milwaukee. Now, Dean, you told me you are not good at Wheel of Fortune kinds of games.
It's embarrassing, Rob. You can give me 5 letters. You give me 10 letters. I'm going to be staring at the screen wondering what the words are. I just cannot seem to put it together, so I tend to stick to Jeopardy. What about you?
I'm pretty good at those word things. Yeah, if I was going to put you on a game show, you think you could take the pressure of Jeopardy?
Well,
Wheel of Fortune's low-key.
The pressure's a little less when you're sitting on the couch and you get a few questions right and you start, you know, feeling the confidence grow. But I'll still take that over Wheel of Fortune.
All right, we'll hold you to that. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.